Now I grew up down an old dirt road in a town you wouldn't know. I still live in the sticks where you wouldn't go. In a town of 1200 off an old dirt road. And a country boy is all I'll ever be.
Hello everybody and welcome back to the Mountain Man Dan Show. We got a kind of cool episode here today. Last week I was talking about running trap line, kind of urban Alaska trap line, which is probably pretty rural by most standards, with my friend Roy. And we actually got Roy here with us today. So Roy, go ahead and say hi.
Hi, everybody. I'm Roy Peters, and I am a local trapper here in Delta Junction, Alaska. I've been trapping since I was a little kid, but really only got kind of serious about it about 5-6 years ago. And I've done okay, I guess, and a lot of it is just the blessing of the Lord, but I've done all right. And I've got a couple wolves now, a couple wolverine, and a few other critters. And I love the outdoors, and I love Alaska, and yeah, that's me.
Yeah, Roy's pretty much like a lot of other Alaskans up here. You know, we like, most of us like going outside and doing things outdoors and getting out of the house and away from the women and away from the children, so It's nice, you know. So yeah, he's got a trap line that goes right here from behind his house, actually. And then he's got another one out behind the lake, one of the local lakes out here. I'm not going to get too specific on that one, but
thank you. I love trapping, but I definitely don't do it to get away from my wife and kids. I love my wife and kids, and actually, I'm looking forward to bringing my kids out on the trap line, and I actually do bring them out quite a bit when it's warm. And, you know, it's not, like, when it's more than zero, it starts getting too cold for them. They don't have quite the body mass and the fat and all that like I do. And
yeah, you're getting a little chubby with all the Doritos you've been eating.
Yeah, I need to probably take off a few pounds, but
yeah. He's getting old enough. That's your oldest son. He's probably getting old enough. He'll be wanting his own snow machine and that kind of stuff to follow you out there here pretty soon.
Yeah.
Have to start looking for an old Bravo short track like I started on. Those are really good sleds for what you can get into them for,
yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah, pretty good if you can find one.
My first one, I found like 6 of them in a dumpster at Midway. We pulled them out and I took them all apart down to the last bolt when I was like 10, 12 years old and put them all back together and got a running one out of it. And I beat the crap out of that sled for a long time. In fact, when I was a kid, most of my trapping, you know, when I was up until I was about 18, 19 years old, I ran that little Bravo short track and it was a great little sled.
That's a good deal to be able to find it for free like that.
Yeah.
That's the best way.
Yeah, you know, everybody, like the Ski-Doo Tundra is like the old ones and the new ones. Everybody wants so much for them. They're really good sleds. You know, and I had that Scandic Super Wide Track last year for trying to run a trap line. I never trusted the thing. It was just problematic. It was kind of a lemon. And then the other thing with that Super Wide, it was just didn't handle nearly as well as I expected with the way it handled in the snow. And just, I never was ever super happy with it. So then I sold it and started looking for a Tundra, and everybody wants so ridiculous
money
for the Tundras.
Ridiculous. Yeah, they want $3,000-$4,000 for those old things now. And you know, the thing is they are good sleds, and they're really great for, you know, breaking trail on a, you know, in skinny stuff, you know, where the trees are thick and they're easy to move around and handle. But they just, you know, today's machines now, they have so much more power and they don't get stuck. And you know, you got reverse if you do get stuck. And so the one I have now that I run my line with is a 550 Ski-Doo Tundra fan-cooled snow machine. And that thing floats great. It's got the ski skins on the front, and it's got the long track with pretty deep lugs, 154 track. And I love it. It could have a little more power at times, but it's still better than a 250cc, I got to say that.
Yeah, I've been looking at the Arctic Cat makes that 600 four-stroke Bearcat, and I've been kind of eyeballing that one, but it's a standard width track. I learned I really don't like those wide tracks or the super wides because they just don't do very good unless you have a pack trail. That one I had was so tippy.
Yeah, and I got stuck.
Yeah, and when you get stuck, there's no way you're getting that thing out of there,
yeah,
on your own.
You might need a 900.
Yeah, I'm a pretty big guy, but you know, when you start getting into like the 900s and that kind of stuff, most of them are mostly mountain sleds, you know, and you can reclutch them and that kind of stuff and make them more trail worthy, but they're just not really built for the kind of riding that you and I do. You know, I don't go up in the mountains and ride just for fun. So it's just like my four-wheeler. You know, I've got the little 400cc four-wheeler. And everybody, oh man, you're 6'10", you need to have a bigger four-wheeler, but I like the little 400. When you get them stuck, you can get them out.
Exactly. Yep. Absolutely. You can handle it.
Yeah, I mean, and you've got pretty much the exact same four-wheeler I have, except yours says Suzuki on it instead of Arctic Cat. And I've been really happy with that Arctic Cat I had. That's been one of the best four-wheelers I've ever had. And I've always had good luck with the Arctic Cat, like the old Arctic Cat Jags and the Arctic Cat Link snow machines. So I'm looking at getting an Arctic Cat next go around. Just because I'm still a little sour over how bad that Scandic was.
Yeah. You can't beat those older Arctic Cats, too. Like, I had an old Cheetah. It was a Cheetah 340. My cousin rolled that thing down the side of a mountain. It rolled at least 9 times. And it was still running when it came to a stop. He jumped back on it and kept going.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, those old two-strokes just run forever. You can't hardly kill them. And if you do kill them, they're like $14 for a new ring and piston set for them. So, and you can still get parts, you know, like from Dennis Kirk or someplace like that. You can still get parts for those old machines like that. That 800 Ski-Doo I had, V-Twin, I mean, it was like, it sounded cool when you fired up. That V-Twin sounded like a Harley Davidson when you fired it up, you know. But if you had any kind of problems with it, you were looking at having to pull the whole engine out. Like, I had to change the thermostat on it. It's liquid cool. And I had to pull the engine all the way up out of the sled to be able to change the thermostat. It was just a pain in the butt.
Yeah, no access to anything.
Yeah, and that thing was just one problem after another. And then it's funny because that was a 2008 or 2009, so it was one of the first four-stroke Ski-Doos. And that machine was so heavy with that super wide long track, and it had the two-up seats and the big cargo area and all that kind of stuff. Power to weight ratio on that was actually lower the Yamaha Enticer 340. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, that's sad.
So, yeah, I was not happy with that sled. And then I told you the story how it caught on fire when I went to go sell it. You know, kind of like the last little insult to injury, you know. But I came home from riding it one day, and I told Amanda, my wife, I said, I'm selling it. And she said, well, you wanted that snow machine so bad. I said, have I ever had fun riding? Have I ever come back like, man, that was fun. That was a good ride. She's like, no, you come back cussing every time. Like, yeah, it's going away.
Yep.
So, yeah, I like those little Tundra, like the 550s. Like, you have a really nice sleds, but again, everybody wants a ridiculous amount of money for those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like
especially this year.
The same thing with the Bravos. You know, I remember in 2011 when they reintroduced the Bravo, my dad bought a brand new one for $3,500 from the Alaska Fun Center in Fairbanks. And I saw one the other day, it had like 1,400 miles on it, and they wanted $5,000. It's like, you paid less than that for it when it was new.
Yeah, that is highway robbery.
So
people shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah. So Roy and I are gonna do a little gear review here real quick. Their gear review is this I've been reading, and anybody that's into outdoors at all, if you read on the internet, at some point the Mora knives are gonna come up. And I don't remember what model this one in, but I keep looking at them, and I was like, that can't be that great of a knife for $19, you know. But finally here a couple weeks ago, I was in Sportsman's Warehouse, and they were on sale, and I picked this one up for $9.99. And I started using it.
Made in Sweden.
Yeah, this is the Companion. So you have the Sweden Mora Knife Companion. And I got it with the orange handle because orange is my favorite color. And I like orange for wood stuff because it's a lot easier or a lot harder to lose.
Exactly. I have the exact same knife. I think great minds think alike.
Yeah.
And you don't lose that bright orange out in the snow.
No, unless your friend leaves your snare pole out there leaning on a tree.
Yeah, but I still found it.
Yeah. So I bought this knife, I think, for $9, you know, if it's junk, whatever. I didn't really have high expectations. I've been using it just around the house. I went and shot some rabbits and grouse and used it to skin and gut those, and used it for peeling potatoes and stuff, you know. Just kind of gave it and put it in the kitchen for about a week and used it around the kitchen, sharpened it up a few times. I've got to say, I'm really impressed with this knife for the money. I would 100%, I want to go buy like 3 or 4 more of them, just throw one in the back seat of my truck, throw one in my backpack, throw one in the center console of my wife's car, because it's a really nice knife for the money. The sheath could be a little nicer. It's just an injected mold. It's like almost like a it reminds me of like the fillet knife sheaths you see in like fishing boats and that kind of stuff. But
it does retain the knife inside of the sheath fairly well. I haven't had it slip out or anything, and it clicks in, so
it doesn't click in too hard like that like that knife you're, that was that a cold steel one?
Yeah, it was a big old knife my brother gave me, but and it's a good one, good knife. But yeah, having being able to pull it out of the sheath when you need to, that's important.
Yeah, because like, you know, a lot of times when you need a knife like this, like up here, we do 9 months out of the year, we're doing stuff in the cold. You know, 8 months out of the year, we're doing stuff in the cold. So you're going to be wearing gloves. And they actually, they put that really nice little thumb, I guess, nub right there. So you can actually lever it out of the sheath a little bit if you have to.
A little leverage, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's not the best. And our friends at Simply Rugged Holsters, they actually make what they call a simple sheath for these knives. And they're, like, right around $20. So if you had a bunch of these knives, you could buy a really nice leather sheath for it if you wanted to carry it on your belt or something like that all the time. But this, to me, is more a knife you throw in your backpack or leaving the truck, you know, and then... Or, like, I'll probably start leaving this one, like, my little toolbox on my four-wheeler.
Yep.
And then, you know, when you get out there and get a moose down, it's nice to have an extra knife sometimes.
Yep. I've used mine on a couple moose, a couple caribou, and it's, it holds an edge really good. And I was using it for my primary skinner for my fur bearer animals, too, until I went to one where I can use interchangeable blades. But it holds an edge very, very well.
Yeah, and see, that's kind of where I was thinking with this one. It'd be great for, it's not like, and I've shown you that Kodiak knife I have, that's my main hunting knife. And to me, this is just a little bit small. If it was a quarter inch deeper blade, an inch longer blade, it'd be an ideal hunting knife. And I think they make them that big.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just a little small for me for a main knife.
Yeah.
But I've got big hands, so.
So that's the companion model.
Right. So, I mean, so that was kind of my thoughts on this one was for like, gutting and skinning rabbits, or if you wanted to skin a coyote out in the field and that kind of stuff, it'd be really good for that. So yeah, I'm really impressed with this little knife for the money.
Yeah, it's like $19. It's not bad.
Yeah, and like, and you'd think I'd be a little less biased. Like I was just showing Roy my little trail hacking hatchet here. I think I paid like $26 for it, and it doesn't, just because it's cheap doesn't mean it's not quality. And I'm kind of learning that a little more.
That's right.
So yeah, and then as far as firearms go this week, I actually did buy a new gun. So our church that me and Roy go to had, they do a yearly men's swap meet, and we had the last one just this past Friday, and this was the first time I've been to one since I moved back to Alaska, and I thought it went really well. There was a lot of guys showed up, a lot of gear got sold and traded and everything else. And I ended up coming home with another Marlin 44 Magnum. About this time last year, here on the podcast, I talked about buying a brand new Marlin Model 94 and 44 Mag. And I think I voiced my distaste for that rifle multiple times on here. It just never lived up to my expectations for accuracy with the barrel, and then it flat out would not stabilize like 300 grain bullets. And I like the 300 grain bullets in a 44 mag, especially in the carbine, because in the carbine you can get about 1500 or 1600 foot per second with those bullets, which is borderline factory 4570, you know, like Federal 300 grain hollow points shoot about 1650, I think. So we're looking at almost as much horsepower as basic 4570 government loads, but I can hold more than twice as many rounds in the tube when it's a 4-inch shorter rifle. So I really like these little Marlin 44 mags for like, you know, out berry picking or in the boat, you know, if you're out fishing along the river and you want something that's reach out and touch stuff a little further than a pistol or a little easier to shoot than a pistol, like for my wife, without having a full-on, you know, 8-pound 4570. So I really like these Marlin 44 mags, and I've had a few of them, but the last one I just wasn't happy with. So I picked this one up at the swap meet. It's a, I looked up serial number, and it was built in 2007. So it was one of the last real Marlins before Remington bought them out. So it is a JM stamped barrel, but being one of the late Marlins, it actually does have a Ballard cut rifle barrel. And anybody that knows the Marlins, you know, we talked about the micro groove. Normally micro groove in a 44 would have like a 12 or a 16 land bore, and this one has a 6 land groove. So it's just generally believed that the Ballard cut are a little bit more accurate, especially with like cast bullets and that kind of stuff. And I think like the Marlin, like the limited runs, like I've got that limited run 3220 and like my first year production 4570. They both have Ballard cut rifles, but generally anything on a Marlin barrel from about 1956 until mid 2000s is going to have what's called the microgroove, and they're kind of highly sought after to find them without the microgrooves. So this one doesn't have a microgroove, and I was kind of happy to see that. And I've got a pretty decent deal on this rifle. We're not going to say what we paid for it here, but I feel like I got a pretty decent deal. And you know, it's got some dings and scratches and that kind of stuff, so I'm not going to feel bad about throwing it in the back, you know, on the back of the four-wheeler and taking the wife out, berry picking and that kind of stuff. And you know, if it gets a ding or a scratch, it gets a ding or a scratch. So
that's what they're made for.
Exactly. So you, what do you usually grab when you go out doing that kind of stuff? You're a shotgun guy, so I'm guessing you probably grab a shotgun with slugs.
Yeah, that's me. Brenneke Black Magic 3-inch slugs is what I like to put in my. It's a F&H P12 shotgun, and you know, I feel like that's more than adequate for up close and personal, you know. And so I bring that a lot of times if I go dip netting at Chitna or somewhere. It's got pretty fast target acquisition sights. They're glow-in-the-dark sights. And,
is that a semi-auto or is it a pump action?
It's a pump.
It's a pump. How many rounds does that hold in the tube?
I think it holds four in a tube and one in the chamber.
So it's got the short tube on it, just a little bit longer in the pump. The 20-inch barrel on that?
Oh, man, I don't even remember.
It's not a pretty short barrel, though, isn't it?
For a shotgun. It's not super long. It has, the sights are like kind of like rifle sights, you know.
Yeah. See, I've always liked, for like a pump-action shotgun, with me being left-handed, I like a tang safety on a shotgun. I don't know what that F&H has for a safety. Is it cross bolt or is it thumb safety?
It's the cross bolt.
Yeah, so I really like the Mossberg shotguns. Mm-hmm. If I'm gonna have a shotgun, they have like the Maverick 88 pardon or pump action. Their little home, it's got like an 8-round tube, 20-inch barrel, and they can get them for like $300. You know, so
yeah,
most of the time that's if I go buy a shotgun. But I'm not really a shotgun guy. You know, up here, if I'm going out grouse hunting or rabbit hunting, I'm grabbing a 22, or like even like my 38 special, and then anything bigger than that, like, yeah, if I go out berry picking or something, I'd grab a lever action rifle for, you know, self-defense, or excuse me, a big bore revolver. So, but just, you know, different, there's nothing wrong with a shotgun for that kind of stuff. They make a big hole really fast.
Yeah, so. I guess if I ever had to be in a gunfight, I'd want to choose a shotgun, because I'm not a genius crack shot, but I can get the job done.
Yeah, this place is called The Last Frontier for a reason. It's only a matter of time before you get into a gunfight with something, whether it be a bear or a moose or a tweaker.
Yep.
Communist.
Yeah, yeah. There's too many of them running around nowadays. Communists.
Yeah, it just seems like it's getting worse all the time. But anyway, yeah. So I wanted to mention that little 44 mag I picked up over the weekend, and then I had some notes on my phone. One of the things I thought was funny is Friday before the swap meet, I went over, and I guess it was earlier in the week than that. It was Wednesday or Thursday. I went over and had a meeting with our pastor Glenn. And I let him shoot that 375 Ruger I bought. And it was hilarious because Glenn hunts with a 375 H&H. He's got an old pre-64 Model 70 Winchester. And I thought it is hilarious letting right-handed people try to shoot that left-handed gun.
It's kind of funny.
Like Glenn, he reached right up there. He went to go work the bolt, and it's not there. And he's like trying to reach over the scope and stuff. And it was hilarious, you know. And I guess I've just gotten so used to running a rifle backward my whole life.
Now you get to see some. Now that you have a left-handed rifle, you get a little revenge on some of those. Rifles,
I never realized how much I was handicapping myself. Like with a lot of the rifle shooting I do when I'm working up loads and that kind of stuff, I shoot off of a bench a lot. So when you're shooting off the bench, you know, it's actually kind of nice. The bolt's right here on this side. The brass comes out on this side. I can, you know, catch my brass and that kind of stuff. And I've just gotten used to leaning my head back and running the bolt with my right hand and holding the gun up. But now that I've actually shot and played with this left-hand rifle and run a couple boxes of ammo through it, I don't know that I'll ever purposely buy another right-handed gun. So
why would you if you're a lefty?
Yeah, I mean, like, I used to kind of bounce back and forth and try to shoot right-handed and be normal, but it's just, I shoot better left-handed. It feels more natural for me. I'm left-eye dominant, so it just makes more sense.
Yep.
So, you know, in an emergency situation, somebody can still use my rifle. I mean, it's not, like, it's just impossible for them to shoot it, but it is funny watching right-handed people trying to shoot that rifle. So I don't think I've let you shoot it yet. We need to get you out there and let you shoot that rifle one of these days.
Yeah. That sounds like a plan.
So that leads up to my first something that was I made a note about. I gotta find my notes here. So somebody asked me about why I was kind of adamant about getting the Ruger with the control round feed. And I think you have your two main working rifles. You've got a Ruger 338 and you've got a Ruger 223, right?
Yeah.
And it's the Gun Scout model.
Yep.
So those both have controlled round feed, which is what I prefer. And somebody asked me why. And the reason is as soon as that bolt contact, you run the bolt all the way back, and as soon as you start pushing it forward and that bolt face touches that cartridge and starts pushing it out of the magazine, it is holding on to the cartridge.
Yep.
It's not going to pop out. With a push round feed, like I've got my Remington Model 700 458 Win Mag. Really cool rifle. A lot of fun to shoot. But if you hold that rifle on its side and start to run the bolt, as soon as that cartridge starts to go forward, it will fall out of the gun. Yep. And if you're trying to do that in a hurry in an awkward position, it will jam the gun up instead of the cartridge is just falling clear.
Yep.
And you're not going to run into that. You can run that Ruger, any of the Ruger with the control round feed, you can run them upside down.
Yep.
And you're not going to have any problems.
When was that design incorporated? Was that during World War II or something like that?
The control round feed's been around since pretty much the start of bolt actions. You know, Mauser's been running that design since the 1800s.
Yep.
So
and that's especially important on a battlefield, you know. Right.
If you are running a cartridge forward and the gun does jam, if it's a bad cartridge or something, again, your extractor is already holding onto that cartridge, so you can yank that cartridge backwards and it'll come out. Yep. Versus trying to happen to beat the gun upside down on the ground by the butt of the rifle and try to knock that cartridge back out. So it's really good for dangerous game. It's really good for cold weather up here because springs and that kind of stuff don't work, especially if you got a gun that's oiled.
Yep.
You know, oil doesn't work good up here. Springs don't work that great in the cold. If it's 40 below, you want as few things to go wrong as possible.
Yep.
Which is another reason I like controlled round feed, because it eliminates the need for a spring-activated ejector. Like if you look at a Savage or a Remington, it's got the little plunger spring ejector built into the bolt, and as soon as the bolt flings, it clears the rifle, it kicks the case out. Where on the Rugers or a Mauser or the old Winchesters or anything like that, they have a blade mounted to the receiver, and when you run that bolt back, you have to run it back quickly. The faster you run the bolt, the further it's going to kick the case out. So if you're target shooting, you just barely work the bolt back, and the cartridge just fall out right there, you know. But they hit that solid pin that's part of the receiver. The chances of you breaking the ejector on a Ruger or a Mauser is almost none. Versus I have had the spring ejectors fail on both Remington and Savage rifles in the cold. Those little springs get gummed up and then it'll do one or two things. It'll kick the case off too soon, shoot the empty back into the chamber. Or it won't kick it off the end of the bolt, and you'll run your bolt back, and the cartridge is still stuck to the end of the bolt. And you got to reach in there with your finger and kick it out.
That's really convenient.
Yeah, really convenient. So I just prefer a controlled round feed. It's just more sure of the cartridge going into the chamber, and there's a couple less things to break. And plus, the extractor is also a lot more robust. And up here in Alaska, something we run into is powders don't act the same from cold weather to warm weather. So if you work a load up in the summer and in the winter, it could do a complete different thing and be too hot for the gun. And you're going to have a much better chance of ejecting a stuck casing with the big claw type extractor versus this little tiny clip on a Remington or a Savage or anything like that. I think it's a lot more durable.
Yep. Rugers are pretty robust. They're built. Overbuilt.
And I've made it abundantly clear that Ruger is pretty much my favorite brand for single action revolvers, double action revolvers, rifles. If they made a pump action shotgun, probably my favorite shotgun too, but they don't seem to feel the need to make a nice pump action shotgun for us.
Benelli's already got that covered.
So, and then the other thing that I crossed my mind, so we were talking about that, and while we're on the subject of rifles, Roy, how much do you know about triggers?
No, I honestly don't know that much. I'm kind of usually I get whatever I get comes from the factory. If it's a little stiff, I'll go take it to somebody and maybe get them to file on it or get it
better. So Roy is more purpose-driven in his rifle buying and pistol buying. All his guns have a purpose, and I just buy guns because I like them. And, you know, I have a few purpose guns that I've had for a long time or I intend on keeping, but I have a pretty good rotating stock of rifles, too. But I like to play with things for this podcast and article writing and that kind of stuff. And I was listening to, I forget if it was a YouTube video I was watching the other day or a podcast I was listening to, but I listen to a lot of podcasts when I'm driving back and forth for work. But have you seen the rifles that have the little blades in the triggers, like the Ruger Americans or the Savage Aki triggers, where they have that little blade in there?
Yeah, I've never really taken them apart and looked at a trigger very much. So
I thought it was interesting. Somebody was talking about his first rifle and learning how to shoot on a Ruger American. It has that blade in the trigger, like a Glock. You know, the blades in a Glock trigger.
Mm-hmm.
So they're putting them in a lot of rifles now. And they were saying that they had such a hard time going to a normal trigger after that. But they got so used to pulling that blade and kind of having some take-ups, they'd start taking up the trigger and the gun would go off.
Oh, gotcha.
So it was just something I thought was kind of interesting. And then this is a personal experience. This is just something that came up yesterday for me, made me think about it. Anybody that's lived in Alaska for any period of time, I'm sure owns a boot dryer. I'm sure you have one. I've got a couple of them.
Yeah, I have a boiler, a wood boiler.
Well, yeah, you've got your boiler room. But, like, so when I go up in the work camps a lot of times, you know, you don't have that up there. You know, you're in these little rooms, normally they're not underheated anyway.
Yep.
So, I've used the peat boot dryers for a long time. And last winter, my peat boot dryer got stolen. So, I went out and bought another one, and it was like a max heat or something like that. Nobody in... And Fairbanks had the peat boot dryers in stock.
At least that's why they stole it. It's good,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, everybody. Yeah, they took it right out of my room.
Wow.
So, well, and it's kind of my fault because. So the last winter I was working up there in New Wistick in the village, and we were staying at the village hotel, and they had this great big boot dryer built into the wall, built out of pipe and tubing, and it was really cool. You know, there's room for 50 pairs of boots. And, you know, you don't see that in normal hotel, but yeah, in those hotels up in the villages, you take your boots off when you walk in the door. That's like if you're going into somebody's house and they had this big boot dryer there. So I just left mine up on the rack with my other, like, backpack and that kind of stuff. I left in that entryway and somebody took it.
Oh, man.
Since I wasn't using it. I wasn't using it, so it wasn't in my room or being used.
Yep.
So I needed another one. I couldn't find any in stock, so I bought it. It's like a max heater, or max dryer or something like that. And instead of having the little arms that come up, they're actually kind of the shape of a boot. It's had these little tubes that come up, and they fold in so the thing can fold them in. It looked like a really neat idea for sticking in a suitcase and taking with you, and it sucks because I wear big boots, and you put a size 14 bunny boot on that thing, and the arms don't have enough. They don't actually support the boot. They'll collapse and fall over. So it's just, and this came back to mind yesterday because I was out behind our house. There's an old Quonset hut that's got a bunch of stuff in it. And I was out there looking for a piece of pipe for a six-wheeler I'm trying to build. And I just walked out there, no snowshoes or anything, in these rubber boots. And I didn't bother to clamp the tops of my boots down. And I wasn't expecting to get in the snow up to my knees. So my boots got full of snow. I was like, I gotta go find my boot dryer now. And I was like, that'd be a good thing to talk about on the podcast.
Found a snow drift and got...
Yeah, I got my boots full of snow and the dog was laughing at me and the wife laughed at me. And I had nice cold wet feet for... about 30 minutes while I was out there looking for my stuff.
Having dry feet is very important in Alaska and anywhere where you're going to be out in the woods for a while. You got to keep your feet dry. And the other thing that I find is I put a little bit of foot powder, some of that stuff in my boots to kind of help. If you're going to be out for an extended period of time, you don't want to have, you know, your feet start itching and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
all, oh, it's terrible.
Bacteria and stuff. Because your feet can actually, if you wear like rubber boots for very long, they won't be wet from the outside, they'll be wet from the inside.
And bunny boots are the same way. Bunny boots are great winter boots for up here, but your feet will be soaking by the end of the day.
Yep.
So like good wool socks make a world of a difference too. Yep. In a little bit. I actually use the just because I don't buy baby powder, I use that the anti-monkey butt powder.
Oh yeah.
Because when we were working down in Texas all the time, you get hot and sweaty and that stuff was a godsend, you know?
Yeah.
So I've still got a few cans of that around. That works pretty good in the boots too to help kind of keep things from dried out a little bit and from stinking as bad as it normally would.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's a big deal keeping your feet dry up here. Like, a lot of times, like, if we go out doing something in the winter, if I go snowshoeing or anything, I'll throw an extra pair of wool socks in my backpack.
Yep.
But you're actually better off taking your feet, you know, as much as it's going to suck at 20 below, taking your feet out of your boots and drying your feet off, you're better to do that than to run the day.
Absolutely.
And have wet feet at the end of the day.
Absolutely true, yep.
It can cause all kinds of problems.
Yep.
In fact, as a matter of fact, if you go out to my pickup parked out here in the parking lot, there's probably a pair of wool socks in the center console.
Yep. Must have. If you're going to have a go bag, have some extra good wool socks in there.
Yeah. So I've got a question for you, Roy. Now, you do a lot of outdoor stuff, and this is something I've been kind of doing a little research on. What do you use for fire starting when you're out there?
I always have more than one fire starting method on me at all times. Of course, I carry matches. I like to get those kind that are the windproof and weatherproof ones, and I'll keep them in some kind of a watertight container, you know, that's small and, you know, fit in a pocket easily. I also carry a lighter.
You know something that works really good for keeping matches dry and waterproof?
What's that?
You're going to laugh at me, but a 10-gauge shell and a 12-gauge shell will slip together and make a waterproof seal.
Oh, that's awesome.
So if you shorten them just a little bit to just the length of matches,
yep,
they just, you know, you'll hear that pop when you pull them apart, that suction.
Yeah.
And they're great. They'll hold about 15 matches. You can stick it in, you know, it's the size of a shotgun shell in your pocket. It actually works really good for that.
Well, that's a good tip, man.
Yeah.
That's great. But yeah, another thing I carry is the magnesium stick. I've got a large one, you know, and that'll, even if you go in the water and you flip your canoe, your boat over, if you got one of those on you, you can light a fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, like, if I'm going out boating in my life preserver, I carry one of those magnesium strike sticks with a small bottle of lighter fluid. Because a lot of times there is no tinder. There is nothing to find. Everything's wet.
Yeah.
And
if you, like, if the rivers up here move so fast, if you tip your boat over in a river, what you have on your person is what you have.
That's right. A lot of times that's all you have.
So that's why, like, you know, I carry a pistol all the time, because if something happened in that situation, you're not going to have, your rifle's gone.
Yep.
Your backpack's gone. Your food's gone.
Yep.
So you need to be able to survive with what's on your person.
Yep.
You know, with a pistol, you can still, you know, shoot something to feed yourself. With matches, you can get a fire to cook it.
Yep.
You know, so it's good to have a fair amount of gear on your person.
That is absolutely true. I try to keep a snack bar or something to keep my energy up. You know, because, you know, high stress situations, you're cold, you're wet. Okay, you got dry. Now you're hungry. And the big part of staying warm is keeping fuel in that furnace, keeping warm,
mm-hmm,
you know, keeping that that core warm, you know. But yeah, I always have more than one method of starting a fire on me. That's very important.
Yeah, and you know, just because it's a nice day when you head out, you know, even in the summer, it can be a nice day out, and it can turn crappy fast. Yeah,
the weather changes so
I've seen
quick.
It in 27 years I've lived in Alaska on and off. I haven't lived here for a full 27, but I'm most of my life I've lived here in Alaska. I've seen it snow every month of the year.
Yep.
You know,
July.
It snowed 4th of July one day, and it was a nice day up until it started snowing.
Yep.
You know, I think it was like 2004 when it did that. And you know, just because it's a nice day, I'm just going to jump in the boat and go down to the Clearwater River over here. Well, guess what? If you tip your boat in the Clearwater River close to the Tanana, where it's deep,
yep,
and you're on the other side of the river,
yep, you're in trouble.
Yeah, because you're going to have to walk 10 miles upriver before you find a place you can cross.
Yep, or a place that you find a cabin or something.
Yeah, it's not. You're not just going to swim across that river. That river will carry you away.
Oh, you'll be dead.
How many bodies, when people fall in the Tanana River, how often do they recover the bodies? It's like 1% of the time.
Yep, very, very rarely.
Yeah, and the Copper River where we go dip netting is the same way. There's a reason, like even full-grown guys that are experienced outdoors guy like Roy and I will tie ourselves off when we're dip netting that river.
Yep.
But if you fall in that river, you're gone. That's it.
Yep. Yeah, I've heard plenty of stories from, you know, older guys that have lived up here a long time. And, you know, they'll be like, telling this another guy, another younger guy, hey man, you should tie off, man. You should tie off. And the guy didn't tie off, and He's got a big king salmon in his net, and it just jerked him right off the rock he was sitting on. It happens. In the river, and then he was gone.
It happens every year.
Yep.
There's several. We had two guys from Delta die on that river last year. Military guys from the base went down there. One guy fell in. The second guy jumped in after him and never recovered either one of them.
Wow. Yeah, it's better to be safe than sorry, and safety is a big deal up here.
Yeah. So
a lot of people laugh about, you know, safety, you know, and... You know, the people that are safe are the ones that are still here.
Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, my dad carried on his person at all times. And this is going to be one that's going to be kind of funny, but he always carried matches, always in the little shotgun shells like I was just telling you. He always carried a gun. He usually carried like a 357 revolver, but he always had a gun on him. And like, I'm that way. I've always got a gun on me just because America says I can.
Yep.
But America, yeah. So, and then he always carried salt on him because he said, even in a survival situation, I don't want to eat unseasoned meat. So he always carried a little bit of salt and pepper on him somewhere so he could keep it dry.
Yeah.
On his person, 24/7, day in, walking around the house, he had a little pack of salt and pepper on him. And he always, whenever he'd go out, he always put one of those little bottles of the military MRE Tabasco sauce.
Oh, Tabasco.
In his pocket, yeah. Too.
That's funny.
So.
That's awesome.
But, you know, he had a situation one time where he had a Rokon. You know what the Rokons are.
Yeah, Honda. No,
they're made by Rokon. They have Honda motors in them now. Right. He had the old one with the little 80cc Chrysler two-stroke in it.
Oh, yeah.
And they advertise that those things will float.
Yeah.
And you can roam across the river and go. So he actually crossed the Tanana. He tipped the Rokon on its side and went across the Tanana with it.
What?
And then, yeah, used it like a little paddle board, got on the other side, and then he lit a fire to dry the thing out and went back into Volkmeyer Lake with it.
No.
Yeah.
That's insane, man.
So, you know, that's what he found out is that he got over there, and he had one of those little butane torch lighters.
Yeah.
It got wet, and it wouldn't work. But his matches that he had...
In the shotgun shells
work fine. He's able to get a fire going. So something I've been looking at for fire starting is those little ferro rods. Have you seen those? They're kind of like, I guess they got magnesium built into them and flint.
Uh-huh.
So when you can use the back of your knife and scrape down, it'll shoot a big pile of burning sparks off.
Yeah.
I've been looking at getting, because I want, it's getting harder and harder to find Strike Anywhere matches.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it is. I tried to get some. I went to Freddy's the other day, and
yeah,
they had none.
You can't hardly find Strike Anywhere matches anymore. And the lighters don't work in the cold. If it's below zero,
I don't care
if that butane lighter's in your pocket. It's not working.
Nope.
So you're looking. So that's what I've been really looking at those. I think they're called the ferium rods, where you can... It's all in one. You strike. You can use the back of your knife, and it actually spits sparks out that'll sit there and burn for a second. So when you can get some kind of tinder, you know, whether you can find the inner bark of a tree that's dry or some grass or whatever, there's always something you can find that's dry. Even if you have to take, and this is where having a good sharp knife, like I always keep my hatchet shaving sharp.
Yep.
Because you can, if it's pouring rain, the inside of a log will be dry.
Yeah.
You know, the inside of the log will be dry. So even if you got to split a log and shave shavings out of the inside under your coat and keep them dry, you can get a fire going if you have an ignition source.
Yep.
So I've been looking at a couple new options. It's getting, like, for 20 years, I've depended on Strike Anywhere matches, and you can't hardly find them anymore.
Yeah. What happened? Why can't we find those on the shelf anymore, you think?
I don't know what it is.
It's crazy.
I think it's because people were making them in a 22 ammo. They don't want us to have 22 ammo these days.
Huh.
But... Because I guess the tip of the Strike Anywhere matches, you can use for priming compound and reload 22s using that stuff.
Wow, well, I didn't know
they make
that.
Little kits for doing that.
That's neat.
So I don't know if they just decided it was too dangerous to make them, or they're too easy for kids to get a hold of for a safety issue. And like you go to Sportsman's Warehouse and buy those little packs of the windproof, waterproof. They're like $20 for a little pack of 10 of them.
That's crazy. And they burn up. It's literally like burning money.
Yeah, but because 90% of the thing is coated with that, with the Strike stuff.
Yeah,
they burn fast.
Yeah, they do, and then they're up to your fingers in no time.
Yeah, and matchbooks work pretty. You can still get matchbooks, and they always have the little Striker on the back. But if it's any kind, if it's windy at all,
yeah, you're not starting a fire.
So yeah, I've really been looking at those little Striker rods. Because it works a lot like the magnesium stick, but it's throwing sparks at the same time, like every time.
That in combination with the lighter fluid You know, you can get a fire started and going hot in a hurry. And,
yeah.
And when you've been in the water and you're cold and you're getting hypothermic, you need heat.
Yeah, now. I went out with a guy, an older gentleman, when we were down in Idaho. I went out with him, and he carried a propane torch, an actual propane blowtorch for fire starting.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're not carrying that on your person if you're on the boat.
No, you're
and
not.
And your boat goes, and like down there, the rivers down there are all kind of lazy, and you can probably get in there and recover your bag. You're not jumping in the Tanana River and recovering your backpack.
No, it's probably.
If you get out of that, if you get out of that river, that's a blessing in itself.
Yep.
Be thankful that you managed to get out of that river alive and forget about the stuff that no longer exists. Yep. It's 20 miles
down
river.
Yeah, it'll be down the river somewhere and so, probably submerged.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, the Tanana is nothing to mess with.
No, so we're going to go ahead and probably start getting this one wrapped up. But one more thing, and yeah, we talked about this, and I'll just tell our listeners about it real quick. So that lady down in Haines that got bit on the butt by the bear. So I'll just kind of go over the story a little bit, and it just goes to show you can never be too careful up here in Alaska. So I know some people down in Haines. I've talked to people down there, and I've kind of got some more details than I want you to see on the news on this. So I guess it was three people went on a camping trip out to a cabin, and it was a brother and sister and then the brother's girlfriend. And they went to a cabin that hadn't been stayed in all winter, and they were going to go out there and do their thing for a couple days, you know, a little getaway. So they get out there, and the sister, right, it's already dark, she goes out to use the outhouse. She sits down in the outhouse and starts doing her business, and she feels something bite her. So she screams, the brother runs out, and she's laying there with her pants down. Something bit me on the butt. So he goes in the outhouse and opens up the lid, expecting to see a squirrel or maybe a marten or something, and there's a grizzly bear head coming up out of the outhouse hole.
Oh.
So he slams the outhouse lid down. None of them had a gun. They get in the house, and I guess she was pretty lucky, but it was just she got one tooth puncture on her bum. So yeah, talking to people down there, I guess the bear was hibernating in the outhouse.
That is a stinky place to hibernate.
if it was a outhouse that wasn't really being used that much, it probably wouldn't be that bad. And bears like stinky, you know, grizzly bears like stinky.
I think it's like perfume, right?
Yeah. So, and maybe next time we get together, we'll talk about bear baiting a little bit and what we kind of plan on doing for bringing grizzlies into a bear bait with stink. But yeah, so they like stink.
They do.
You know? And so anyway, yeah, so I guess the bear had knocked a couple big rocks and got down in there and was hibernating in the outhouse hole, and it woke up when she started, you know, tinkling on it. And I really don't know who I feel worse for in this situation. I mean, as bad as it is to get bit on the butt, it's pretty bad to, you know, get bombed on and woke up that way. I mean, that's got to be one of the worst ways in the world to wake up. So I don't really blame the bear for biting her, you know, but...
Yeah.
Anyway, I just thought that was kind of a humorous story.
Yep, big surprise.
So, you never know what you're gonna come up to. No, we live. Neither one of us really lives by Lower 48 standards. We're both rural. I mean, my closest neighbor's a half mile away. Oh my God, I'm rural. And by Alaska standards, I actually live within city limits. You know, and you know, by Alaska standards, we're pretty urban here. You know, But, you know, we could walk out that garage door right now and a black bear could be coming through the yard, even though it's the middle of winter. They do wake up and they're hungry and they're looking for stuff.
Well, it's interesting because bears don't truly hibernate like, you know, some other animals do. Like,
they do wake up and, you know, they go out and use the bathroom and look for a snack here and there. They do get up and move around in the winter. I've seen them do it.
Yep.
And, like, you know, and everybody, though, neither one of us lives out that far from town. But one of the most populated, one of the biggest black bear populations in this area is out where the old dump was off of Tanana Loop Road. That's right between you and me, you know?
It's not very far.
Five miles from here. And if a bear smells something delicious, he can cover 5 miles pretty quickly.
Especially when they're hungry in the middle of the winter. You know, a lot of times those bears that wake up, you know, they were ones that didn't quite find enough to eat, you know, during the summer and fall months, and they wake up and they're hungry.
You know, I get up in the middle of the night to use the bathroom. I'm hungry, you know. I situated our house where the fridge was on the way to the bathroom from the bedroom, you know. So, and these are the reasons I'm fat, but, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I can imagine. And they wake up. Everybody's like, oh, it's wintertime. You don't have to worry about bears. That's complete bull crap. There's bears out there in the winter. You know, we go out, You go out and run your trap line out there behind. There's all kinds of bears out there.
Yep.
And they hear your snow machine drive by, and on the way back, they're sitting there like, hey, here's dinner.
Yeah, thankfully they have quite the fear of humans still. So
normally they kind of tend to stick to themselves. You know, even the ones that... There's two kinds of bears. You know, there's ones that have never really seen a human, and they're usually curious. And they're the ones, like, in the southeast where they're along the river where everybody's fishing and stuff. They don't generally care as long as you leave them alone.
Yep.
But they're unpredictable. You never know when one's just going to decide to turn around and take a swat at you.
Because they're the apex predator out there, and they're used to being...
Just because they don't bother you 99% of the time doesn't mean that one's not going to.
Nope.
So
it's better to be prepared.
It's better to be prepared. Anyway, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap that one up here. I'm hoping maybe we can start having Roy on the show a little bit more. You know, he's got a lot more in common with me being here in Alaska, and... Him and I actually have some plans to go out on a bear hunt this spring and do some different stuff together, and I'm hoping maybe he'll be interested in coming on the podcast a little more.
Yeah.
So
yeah, this has been fun.
Yeah, it's been a really good time. So, as usual, I really appreciate everybody taking the time to listen to our show. Hopefully the audio quality on this episode was pretty good. My microphone actually broke last week, so we're just using the computer microphone on my wife's laptop here in Roy's garage. It's nice and quiet out here, and I thought maybe we'd be able to not have too much background noise. So hopefully the audio on this episode was pretty good. But, yeah, we really appreciate everybody tuning in, listening to the show, and we'll see everybody next time.